From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson. In 1975, he became the first black manager in Major League Baseball. He just took over the Baltimore Orioles, and he's trying to get them out of last place. Also today, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Teresa Carpenter explains her fascination with the obsessions of others, obsessions that often lead to murder. Three members of the New Orleans band Beausoleil perform a couple of Cajun dance tunes, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the dance and choreography of Marc Morris. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson has made several breakthroughs during his career. He was the first player to win both the American League and National League Most Valuable Player Award. In 1975, he became the first black to manage a major league team. The team was the Cleveland Indians. In 1983, when he was managing the San Francisco Giants, he was named Manager of the Year. Robinson has written a new autobiography titled Extra Innings. He opens it by explaining that he was never outspoken about injustices to minorities in baseball because outspoken blacks were considered troublemakers. He knew he eventually wanted to manage, and what owner would hire a troublemaker who's black? But now that Robinson is in management, he's become more outspoken about racism in baseball. And he's a founding member of the Baseball Network, a group of black former players trying to counteract the white old boys network. Several weeks ago, Robinson became the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. He was already working there as special assistant to the president of the team. It's an opportunity for him to manage again, and he's managing a team he used to play with, the team he says he liked playing for best. But he's inherited a team firmly entrenched in last place. I asked him if he has ambivalent feelings about the new job.
No, not at all, Terry. I knew when I took the job what the situation was. I thought I could come in and help this team turn itself around, and we're starting to play a little bit of better baseball, and I think before the season's over, we'll have a respectable season. And, you know, I didn't really want to come back to managing, but they asked me to, and I felt like I could help this ball club.
Do you have a long-term strategy of how to turn the team around?
No, I don't. I've talked it over with our general manager, Roland Heeman, and also our owner, Edward Bennett Williams, and the other people in the organization, my thoughts on what this ball club and this organization has to do, and that is I think we have to build through our farm system. In other words, start putting talented prospects into the farm system. When we make trades, we get some top prospects back to put into our farm system. If we can build a farm system back, I think we'll have a winning team at the major league level.
You've actually been very critical of the minor leagues for not giving the kind of training that they used to.
Well, yes, and it's not just the minor leagues. Maybe it's unfair to the minor leagues. I think it goes back farther than the minor leagues. I think it goes back to Little League, high school baseball, sandlot baseball. Well, in the old days, and I don't like to talk about them too much, you had ex-professional baseball players as coaches and just teachers to teach you how to play the game. They gave you the good, sound, fundamental baseball, and they gave you a good foundation. You knew how to play the game when you came into professional baseball, and it was just a matter then of polishing your skills. But now it's you're teaching at every level in baseball, and even in the major leagues, when players come to the major leagues, you're still teaching them how to play the game, and it's very difficult to do that and try to win.
When Al Campanis made his now infamous remark about blacks lacking the necessities to manage, you were, debating him on TV shows about that statement and so on. Do you think that the major leagues are being shamed at all into making sure that they hire more blacks into management positions?
Well, I don't think they're being shamed into it. I think finally, with the problem out in the open, Al Campanis making that statement that a lot of us had been saying for years the problem existed, and the people in baseball said it did not exist, and finally the closet door was opened by someone on the inside, and this dreadful secret had been exposed. I think baseball finally said, okay, we do have a problem, and we're going to do something about it, and they have set out to do something about it now.
Well, you said that his statement was exposing a dreadful secret that you already knew about. How In what ways did you know of that kind of racist sentiment existing within management?
Well, you just look at it over the years since Jackie Robinson broke the barrier as a player. No one until 1975 was offered a job to manage a major league ball club. I mean, a minority or a black. And you can't tell me up until that time there was no other qualified blacks to manage in the major leagues. And since that time, it's only been two other blacks that were qualified to manage in the major leagues. I just can't believe that. And also, there hasn't been one general manager in the history of the baseball to run a ball club. There's no ownership at all in baseball. There's no one at the level of a head of scouting in the major league baseball club, and only one farm director. And I must retract that statement. I think the late Bill Lucas was a general manager for a short period of time at Atlanta. And Hank Aaron right now is the farm director at Atlanta. I just can't buy that those few people are the only ones that have been qualified to hold those type of positions in baseball.
My guest is Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson, now the manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and author of a new autobiography titled Extra Innings. Now, you were the first black manager in the majors. Did you go through a kind of credit to your race syndrome of knowing that you were going to be the example, that everything you did was going to be an example of, well, can blacks manage or not? Do you know what I mean? That I think the first person in a situation like that is going to be looked at as an example, and it's quite a responsibility to have, and it could be very inhibiting.
Well, there's no doubt about it, Terry. I went through that when I was the manager of the Cleveland Indians. Just take, for example, opening day, and I put myself in the lineup, and I don't know why. But I was on deck as the second hitter in the lineup, and it had to be 50 cameramen standing there snapping my picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to climb over them to try to get to the batter's box. And everything that I did that year was recorded and reported, and every move that I made, everyone was second guessing. And if it didn't turn out right, they were saying I should have done something else. If it turned out right, you know, it was still, well, he might have been lucky doing that. Sure, I knew that, and I knew that I would be judged, and other minorities would be judged by what I did and how I performed. But I couldn't worry about that. I just had to go out and do the best job I possibly could do. And if the players performed the way they were capable of performing, I knew that we would have a good year. And if they didn't, I knew we'd have a bad year. As simple as that.
You had a lot of difficult adjustments to make going from playing to managing. And you write in your book that one of the most difficult adjustments was actually learning to work with pitchers because you'd hated pitchers so much as a batter yourself.
Well, that's true. I think that's the most delicate part, I think, of managing, other than dealing with the press, is handling pitchers. And a lot of people think that other than an ex-pitcher, managers don't handle pitchers very well because they don't know how they think. They don't know how they really act. They don't know how they feel. But I think that's an art. It's a feel for your personnel. You get to know them, you know, what happens to them when they get out of sync, you know, what happens to them when they're on their game, and when they start to lose it in the late innings. A lot of people want a manager change pitchers in the middle of a ball game just by chance. No, it's not by chance. It's by feel, knowing that individual, what he does when he's starting to lose a little bit off his fastball or starting to lose his control. Each pitcher has his own little thing that tips you off by what he's starting to do in a ball game if he's starting to lose his stuff.
You certainly knew as a player what made for a good pitcher. How did you overcome your resistance to really working with pitchers once you got into management?
Well, I had to overcome it.
Right.
They were on my team, and I had to get the most out of them. And it wasn't easy. At Cleveland, I was probably a little impatient with some pitchers and went to the bullpen a little quicker than I probably should have on different occasions. But when you have a good bullpen, and we did have a good bullpen in Cleveland, David LaRoche was there, Jim Kern was there, and I thought they were outstanding relief pitchers, and they did a good job for me. So in the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning, I didn't hesitate to go to the bullpen to bring them into the ballgame. Also, we didn't have, on our pitching staff, we didn't have pitchers that completed too many games or had the ability at that time to complete too many games. So, you know, I went out and got them a little quicker than probably I normally would have.
When you're in baseball, you have to learn how to deal with being released or being fired. Now, you were released from the Giants and Indians and as manager. Did you have to learn how to keep your confidence after that?
Well, when I was fired from the Cleveland Indians in 1977, I was devastated. I was hurt. It really bothered me a lot. And the day that I was fired, I didn't want to talk to anyone. And I did talk to the players and I talked to the press. I could handle that. But once I left the ballpark, I didn't want to accept any calls or anything like that. I didn't want to talk to my family, although they were around, and they understood that. So they just kind of stayed away from me for a couple of days. But I got my act back together and said, hey, this is part of baseball. This is life, and life goes on. And I wanted to stay in baseball, so I just said, if it happens, it happens. And 3 weeks after I was fired, I was back in baseball. The second time at San Francisco, it didn't hurt as bad. I just didn't like the way they went about it in the middle of the night, like 12:30 at night, after we had won a ball game and I was back in my hotel room, and the owner flew into town, into Atlanta, as a matter of fact, and fired me in the middle of the night. I didn't like the way that went about, but it didn't bother me. It didn't hurt me as badly as the first time.
You know, when you're a teammate, when you're a player, you have all these players who are on the same level you are, and there's a certain solidarity between the players. When you're a manager, you're alone in a way that you're not alone when you're a player. Is that something that you miss, that sense of, you know, being on the same level with the team?
Well, there's no doubt about it. You do miss that togetherness and that closeness and the friendship. And it's a shame, really, in a way, that the manager is looked upon as the bad guy. And he's off by himself. And this is really why it's so important to have a coaching staff that you feel very comfortable with and you enjoy being around you. Because really, those are the only people that you really have a chance to talk to and to let your inner feelings out and discuss things with. Because the players are really... the coaches are the good guys. They will tell things to the coaches that they won't dare say to the manager, because I'm the one that take them out of the lineup. I'm the one that pinch hits for them. I'm the one that don't play them that day. I'm the one that goes out and take the starting pitcher out and bring a relief pitcher in. I'm the one that didn't bring the relief pitcher in that felt like he should be in the ball game. Those type of things. So I'm the bad guy. So it's you're kind of off in a little world by yourself, but. Also, you don't want to get too close to the players because you're management and you're the one that has to make the decisions. And it's very difficult if you become real close to the players to make those decisions. You don't want those personal things to interfere with your decisions as far as the ball club is concerned. Yeah. So it is kind of lonely as far as the manager is concerned.
As a manager, what's your approach to confronting a player who you suspect is using drugs?
Well, that's a very touchy subject and situation. Because I've never seen a player use drugs myself personally. You only suspecting him of doing something. And there are ways to approach it, but you just cannot come right out. I don't feel like you can, and say, I know you're using drugs. You sit a player down and you talk to him about the evils of using drugs, the drawbacks of using drugs and what it can do to an individual personally. And also what it can do to his performance on the field, and it may cost him his career and things like that. And hopefully you can get through to him to where if he does have a problem, he will seek help.
Okay, my guest is Frank Robinson, who is a Baseball Hall of Famer now, the manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and the author of a new autobiography titled Extra Innings. Let's talk a little bit about your career as a player, quite an illustrious career. Now, you say in your book that you really didn't know anything about racism until you entered baseball in 1953. Was that your first exposure to segregation?
Well, it certainly was. As I was growing up in Oakland, California, I certainly knew the difference in the color of my skin and some of my friends and neighbors and people lived in a neighborhood. But those things never interfered with the friendship and the relationship that I had with those people. And around my household, my mother, my brothers, color of other people's skins or racism or prejudice was never discussed. We treated everyone the same. And if I didn't like someone, it wasn't because of the color of their skin. And when I entered baseball and couldn't go to a movie in Ogden, Utah because of the color of my skin, I was really hurt very badly. That was the first time I'd really been away from home for any length of time. And also, you know, the area I had to live in, I had to live in the black area of the city. So that really bothered me. And the next year, it wasn't any better. I started in Tulsa, Oklahoma for 8 ball games, and I wound up in Columbia, South Carolina. And we had bus trips and things like that, and it wasn't much better at all, where you had to sit on the bus while the other players went into a restaurant to eat. And you had, once you arrived at a city, you had to sit on the bus and wait for a cab to come from the black section of town to pick you up and take you back over there to go to the YMCA or private home to stay. So it was very, very hard on a young man from California that didn't grow up with those type of feelings, didn't really know anything about that, to start out in baseball and find out about those things.
Did you get any kind of support from management?
No, none
moral
whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not really. I guess they just felt like, hey, this, you signed on to do a job, and this is a job, and this is the conditions you have to play in.
Mm-hmm.
So go out and do your job.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your playing, but first we're going to take a short break. Frank Robinson is my guest, Baseball Hall of Famer, manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and author of the new autobiography, Extra Innings. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson is my guest. In the majors, you developed a reputation for being a very aggressive player. One of the things you became known for was sliding into second with your spikes up and frequently knocking into the second baseman. What were your guidelines there? You say your ethic was win any way you can win within the rules. What were your kind of guidelines in your own head about how to slide into second and to be intimidating but not to take that too far?
Well, Terry, I'll tell you, I never slid into a base to intentionally hurt anyone, but I had a job to do, and my job was to try to break up the double play any way I possibly could do that. That's the way I was taught how to play the game when I was a kid, and that's the way I played the game throughout my playing career. And the idea was to go in there any way you possibly could. I never really, in my heart, went in with my spikes what I call high.
Mm-hmm.
But as people might know from the old days, as we said, old shoes, baseball shoes in those days had metal spikes on the bottom of them. And when I slid into the base, naturally those spikes were facing the infielder, the shortstop or the second baseman or whoever. And if it happened to come in contact with their body, the possibility of them being cut was there. And it did happen, and on occasions it did happen, and just players thought that I was maybe a little vicious, but I was never vicious as far as my playing was concerned, as far as sliding into bases. You know, I was injured also with spikes. Sliding the second, I missed a shortstop. He went up in the air. He came down on my arm and gave me 30 stitches in my bicep, and the doctor said if it had been half an inch lower, my career would have been over, but I didn't worry about it. I just had it stitched up and came back in 10 days and played.
Well, if you ended up spiking a player as you were sliding into second, would there be a payback later in the game?
Well, the possibility was there. The next time I was up at home plate, the possibility of being hit in the ribs, hit in the head was there, but I never let that bother me. I went up to home plate and didn't worry about it. Also, the possibility the next time I was going down to second base, if the second baseman, the shortstop, got the ball in time before I had a chance to slide, the possibility they were going to try to stick one between my eyes. But I didn't worry about that either. That was all part of the game, and I knew that, and I knew the price that I might have to pay going into a base if that did happen.
Let's stay at home plate for a minute. You also used to crowd the plate a lot as a hitter. Explain the strategy of that, of standing really close to the plate when you're batting.
Well, I changed my stance when I came to the major leagues. I moved right up on top of the plate, and I bent over at the waist and just stuck my elbows out over the inner part of the plate. And the strategy in that was to take the outside part of the plate away from the pitchers. I thought and I felt like, and I still do, that the pitchers in the major leagues was much smarter and able to get the ball where they wanted to much more so than they did in the minor leagues. And I didn't want to give them the outside part of the plate because that's the biggest part of the plate, and I thought they could more consistently make their pitches out there. So that's why I did that.
So it gives you certain advantages over the pitcher. On the other hand, it's a kind of dangerous position to take because you're more likely to get hit by a ball if you're that close to the plate.
No, it's no doubt about it. I was hit 198 times.
Is that a record?
It was for a while until Ron Hunt came along, and he upped the record to 250 times.
Wow.
And now Don Baylor has it going is close to 300 times right now and counting. So it was quite a few in those days, and so now look at Don Baylor, been hit almost 300 times. It's mind-boggling, really. But, you know, that was all part of the game. I would be thrown at, knocked down, whatever, and you would get up and just do damage to the pitcher with the bat. And that's the only way I looked at it, I didn't really worry about it, as long as I didn't feel like a pitcher was throwing at my head intentionally.
What were your tricks for getting out of the way of the ball?
Recognizing the pitch right away, knowing that it's a fastball rather than a curveball. And certainly if a fastball is up and in, you better get down real quick. And we were taught to roll our front part of our body back towards the screen. In other words, you roll your front shoulder back and hopefully and pull your, tuck your head down and into your body to protect your head and face so the ball would hit you in the meaty part of your back so you wouldn't be hurt very seriously.
You have said that when a pitcher threw intentionally at a player on your team, that you would tell your pitcher to try to reciprocate in some way?
Well, at times, if I thought they were doing it intentionally because a hitter had been hot and had been hitting the ball pretty good against that pitcher or that ball club, I have at times early in my career as a manager said to our pitchers, I want you to hit this guy on the knee. I never said in the head or anything like that. I always made the target lower than that I thought maybe the pitcher might aim at. So I always said, hit this guy on the knee. But I can honestly say I can't remember any pitcher really going out there and doing that. I had some that tried to do it. They threw the ball back to the backstop to hit the screen. They threw the ball in the dirt and missed the player by 3 or 4 feet. But I can't really remember pitcher really after I told him to do that going out there and doing it.
Let's get back to your ethic of win any way you can within the rules. Did you think of like telling a pitcher to to hit someone as being within the rules?
Well, I thought so. I think being hit is within the rules. That's all part of baseball and has been ever since baseball has been played. And what you do is you're saying I'm protecting my own. The hitters are going up to home plate trying to score runs for the pitcher. And the only way our pitcher is going to win ball games is if we do score runs. And if the other team is taking advantage of the situation and throwing it out of hitters to try to make them a little gun-shy at the plate or hitting them to where they cannot stand up there and do their job with the bat, then he has to protect his teammates. And that's the only reason why on occasions that I asked my own pitchers to do that.
Frank Robinson is my guest, Hall of Famer and manager of the Baltimore Orioles, also author of the new autobiography, Extra Innings. Now, I think initially in the majors, you had the reputation of being an overly aggressive, maybe kind of mean player. And then I think the attitude toward you really changed and you started to really be, you know, very, very loved by fellow players. What changed in the way you were viewed by the people in the majors?
I think the only thing that changed in the way that I was viewed by players is that players got to know me. Either they became teammates of mine and got to know me in that respect, or they started to get a little closer to me by chatting with me about hitting when we had some spare time before a ball game and things like that. And they found out that Frank Robinson really wasn't a bad guy after all. I think a lot of people just made judgments on my character and me before they really got to know me.
You are now a Baseball Hall of Famer and manager. Are there any special advantages or problems that a star player like you faces when moving into a management position?
Well, I think you put you under the microscope. They're always checking you out to see what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And also, I think a lot of people think that just because you're not successful right away or you're not successful, that outstanding players cannot manage in the major leagues. And I think that's one of the things that I've been fighting for a long time. And I said, you know, name me one outstanding player that's been given a good team to manage, and no one can come up with a name, because most of the time when you hire an outstanding player, it's usually he's usually given a bad team because that team has failed. And you feel like if you name an outstanding player to manage that ball club, it was also attract improve the attendance, number one, and maybe the players will respond because of the respect they have for the player for what he has achieved in his career.
Is that the kind of position you feel in now?
Not as much as I did the first two times around. And everyone always thinks that Frank Robinson wants his players to play the way he played the game. That's another thing, and that's couldn't be anything farther from the truth. No, I think with this ball club, it's a mature ball club to an extent, especially our top players. I've been around them for quite some time as a coach and as an executive, and they know me as an individual. They know me, they know what I did as a player. They didn't see me play because they weren't old enough. But I think it's a much better situation here than it was at San Francisco and Cleveland as far as that's concerned.
What are some of the things as a manager you keep in mind about what you learned as a player? In other words, things from the player's perspective that now you can keep in mind as a manager.
Well, I think the main thing is the way I want to be treated as a player. I think that is the most important thing. I try to treat the players under me as a manager the way I wanted to be treated as a player. And I think if you can do that, the players will respond for you and to you.
Is there a moment in your career that you think of as your greatest moment in baseball?
No. I had 21 years as a player, and I've coached on a number of years and been on a couple of winners. And I've managed, and I haven't been a winner yet as a manager, but I just cannot pick out one instance and say this is the greatest thing that happened to me. I think one of the things that really turned my career around was being traded to the Baltimore Orioles.
It's the team in your book that you describe as the only team when you were a player where the black players and the white players hung out together.
Well, that's true. At Cincinnati, I was treated very well at the ballpark and on the field and around the players when we were together on the road and everything like that. But once we were away from the ballpark, we didn't that was the togetherness wasn't there. But at Baltimore, it was just a real great atmosphere and a real good feeling among the players from the time that I stepped on the field in Miami, Florida. It was the first spring training game that we had and the first in a squad game. First time I stepped on the field, that feeling was just there. It was like a family affair, and it was a togetherness and closeness among all the players. No one was treated any differently than anyone else.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your career as a player and a manager. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me on, Terry.
My guest has been Frank Robinson, Baseball Hall of Famer, who's now the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. He's the author of a new autobiography, which is titled Extra Innings and is published by McGraw-Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Christopher Matthews. He's a syndicated columnist and Washington bureau chief for the San Francisco Examiner. He's also served as chief spokesman for House Speaker Tip O'Neill. And he's written a new book titled Hardball, How Politics is Played by One Who Knows the Game. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Teresa Carpenter is fascinated by murder. It's her job to be. She writes about crime for the Village Voice. Coming up, she describes the case of a medical professor's obsession with a Boston prostitute, an obsession that led to murder. It's the subject of her new book, Missing Beauty. Also today, Cajun fiddler Michael Doucette returns with two members of his band, Beau Soleil, to perform a couple of dance tunes, and critic at large Laurie Stone takes a look at the dance and choreography of one of America's most commissioned young performers, Mark Morris. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The House Ethics Committee has decided to launch an investigation into allegations of wrongdoing on the part of House Speaker Jim Wright. The committee will determine whether there are any violations of House rules that warrant discipline by the full House. Details from NPR's Cokie Roberts.
The vote was unanimous. The 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans on the Ethics Committee agreed to conduct a preliminary inquiry into various actions taken by House Speaker Jim Wright over the years. Now, Republicans on and off the committee are pressing for the appointment of an outside counsel, a lawyer who will be free to fully investigate the man who is the virtual boss of the House of Representatives. For the first time today, Speaker Wright went public with statements and documents explaining or refuting all of the charges against him, and he expressed his conviction that he would be exonerated. While the man who brought the complaint to the Ethics Committee, Georgia Republican Newt Gingrich, said the decision by the committee to pursue an inquiry is good for the country and for the House of Representatives. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
The White House announced today that all Panamanian officials linked to the regime of General Manuel Noriega will be barred indefinitely from entering the U.S. More from NPR's Richard Gonzalez.
The unexpected move is the latest maneuver of the Reagan administration in its campaign to force Noriega from power. It is also the first sign of activity from the administration since May 25th, when Noriega rejected a deal to step down. Under President Reagan's order, any Panamanian diplomat representing the Noriega government will be barred immediately from entering the U.S. until such time as Secretary of State George Shultz determines that democracy has been restored in Panama. It is unclear how many Panamanian officials would be affected by the order, although it would appear to target any government official serving Noriega's hand-picked president, Solis Palma. The U.S. maintains that deposed President Eric Del Valle is the legal chief of state in Panama. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The impasse has been broken between the U.S. Customs Service and a peace convoy of U.S. war veterans, which was stymied in its efforts to deliver humanitarian aid to Nicaragua. Details from NPR's John Burnett.
The Veterans Peace Convoy is declaring a complete victory in its fight to take 37 vehicles and 40 tons of food, medicine, and clothing to the children of Nicaragua. The U.S. Customs Service stopped the convoy in Laredo, Texas on Wednesday, claiming the pickups, vans, and school buses violated a 3-year-old economic embargo against Nicaragua. But it backed off today on its demands that the convoy put up $100,000 in bonds for the vehicles. The veterans say they're still deciding whether or not to leave the vehicles in Nicaragua, which the Customs Service prohibits. Texas Congressman Albert Bustamante and Massachusetts Senator John Kerry were circulating a letter of support among their colleagues. They argue that Customs was being unfair because other groups had sent ambulances and garbage trucks to Nicaragua in the past. The convoy expects to cross the international bridge into Mexico on Monday morning. In Austin, this is John Burnett reporting.
8 people were killed and 50 wounded today in Beirut. One was a Syrian soldier who was killed when a shell landed on a Syrian army position during fighting between rival Palestinian factions at 2 refugee camps. Since Thursday, guerrillas loyal to PLO chairman Yasser Arafat and his rival, Abu Musa, have been fighting each other. The Reagan administration informally notified Congress today of its intent to sell Kuwait 40 F-A-18 Hornet fighter bombers and nearly 600 missiles. The weapon sale, for an estimated $1.9 billion, is designed to help Kuwait defend itself against Iranian attacks. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 8 points to close at 2101.71. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We've got some dance music for you on our weekly performance spot. Three members of the Cajun dance band Beau Soleil are with us. Michael Doucette on fiddle and vocals, his brother David Doucette on guitar and vocals, and Jimmy Bro on accordion. Michael's going to introduce the first tune.
All right, we're going to start off playing a traditional two-step called Two-Step Dacadienne. It's the Cajun two-step. Okay, for the next song, we'd like to play a waltz, a beautiful waltz called Tous les deux pour la même, which roughly translated means if you can't have the one you love, try two others. David's going to sing this song. Alors.
Thank you. la paix dans ma main. Et fatigue pour chercher au même de la maison. C'est pas la peine de dire non, sera toujours te dire.
Michael Doucette, David Doucette, and Jimmy Bro will be back with us next week. Beausoleil's latest album, Bayou Boogie, is on the Rounder record label. Fresh air. In 1981, the year that the Pulitzer Prize was taken away from Janet Cook for fabricating a story, it was awarded instead to Teresa Carpenter for her Village Voice reporting on three murder stories. One of those stories, about actress and Playboy centerfold Dorothy Stratton, was adapted into the film Star 80. Carpenter's new book, Missing Beauty, is the result of her investigation into the 1983 murder of a Boston prostitute named Robin Benedict. Her killer, William Douglas, was a Tufts University research scientist. Journalist Teresa Carpenter is drawn to stories involving the murder of a spouse, lover, or mentor, situations where love turns to obsession and results in murder, the ultimate form of control.
When I was assigned my first crime piece by an editor at the Village Voice, I found it was invigorating working with an event that was absolutely undeniable. I mean, when a murder occurs, when any act of violence occurs, it's something happened. You know it happened, and the energy that gives you is considerably more invigorating than say, reporting on the state of the economy. At least I found that to be the case.
What got you onto the Robin Benedict story?
One afternoon in the fall of 1983, I was skimming the New York Times and ran across an account of the Douglas case. It was shortly after Dr. Douglas had been indicted, and I was absolutely fascinated by it. I mean, you had a very distinguished professor of cell biology who was living an apparently conventional life in many respects, yet found himself in the combat zone, which is Boston's red light district. Obsessed with a prostitute who came out to his home one evening in the suburbs, the home he shared with his wife and three children, and disappeared. I mean, clearly something very interesting happened there, and it had me hooked from the first moment I read it, and I was hooked for the full 4 years I was researching the story.
So what were the questions you really wanted to answer?
Well, I wanted to know how she got out there to the suburbs that night. Their lives, all four of their lives intersected at that point. What was the wife doing? How did she allow that to happen? What was Douglas thinking to allow a prostitute into his home? Who was this prostitute? Was she an unusual woman that she would be allowed into his home? Was she a friend? Was she a friend of the family? I mean, people are often not what they seem, and I was curious as to what kind of persona these people had developed in dealing with one another.
Now, what you found out about the killer, William Douglas, was that although His colleagues described him as a meticulous scientist and a crashing bore, that he was living this this double life, that he had a long-term relationship with Robin Benedict, who was a prostitute. He paid for the relationship, and he'd even embezzled over $167,000 in research funds to support her and to keep them both in cocaine.
Yes, it's interesting that at the point Douglas met Benedict, he was at a very precarious juncture in his life. He had just turned 40. He was bumping up against the limits of his ability as a scientist. He was very distinguished in one area, which was cell culture, but he was never going to be a Schweitzer. I mean, he had to acknowledge that fact. And he was looking, as he later wrote in some of his love letters, for a new hope for living, someone or something who would transform him from the rather drab creature that he was into an exciting, svelte man of the world. And Robin Benedict, for her part, was very skillful at creating that kind of illusion.
What's kind of her job, too? That's what she gets paid to do, in a way.
Yes, yes, it is. Although it was interesting to me, in talking to other girls in the combat zone, other working girls, prostitutes, that there is a certain rudimentary code of conduct that you use in dealing with a John, and that's that if he appears to be coming attached to you, you have to reinforce that this isn't love you're feeling. You know, this is physical attraction, and I'm sending you home to your wife in the suburbs. You know, there are girls who you will lead a guy on, but in talking to the women, the combat zone, it's generally not a good policy, because then you raise expectations you can't fulfill, and they do become nuisances. Benedict, either because she was inexperienced, she had only been in prostitution a few months at the time she met Douglas, or because she was greedy, did encourage his emotional attachment to her, and indeed left him with the impression that she was fond of him. And that, I believe, is why the relationship got out of control.
William Douglas was not a professional killer. But he not only killed Robin Benedict, he disposed of the body in such a way that it's still never been found.
That's correct. I think that is one reason why this case continues to exert the influence on public imagination that it does. Robin's body was never been found.
But don't you find it interesting that an amateur killer would be able to dispose of the body so effectively that it still eluded, you know, professional crime investigators?
You're right in that it is very difficult to dispose of a body. I mean, they, if you throw them in the river, they tend to float. You know, it's hard to get rid of a body. But a non-criminal, such as Douglas, flailing around in a moment of passion, might just hit upon the scheme accidentally that would perfectly dispose of a body, and apparently he did. You know, at one point, there was a theory much in vogue that Douglas had taken the body to his laboratory at Tufts and disposed of it chemically, or perhaps preserved it chemically and then hid it someplace where he could go to visit it, the theory being that he may have been as obsessed with her in death as he was in life. I think we may never know.
You spent, I think it was 3 years in Boston doing research on the story, and you had to spend probably a lot of time in the combat zone, Boston's porn and prostitution district. Did you have to learn how to win the trust of prostitutes who you needed to speak to?
Yes, that was a very difficult aspect of the reporting. I am not a street person myself, and never have pretended to be, and so it took a period of time of cultivating sources, people I had been introduced to through other journalists. I know one friend had a girlfriend who danced as a stripper in the combat zone. She introduced me to a bouncer who in turn introduced me to a bartender. And coming in that way with letters of introduction, so to speak, I managed to integrate myself a little more gracefully than I would have had I just gone down and started sitting in bars.
Of all the murders that you've written about, which one still troubles you the most, or which one had, like, the most personal impact on you?
Well, I think because I lived 4 years with the Douglas case, this has probably affected me the most deeply. I mean, you can't be immersed in a situation like this for that long without it affecting your sleep, and I did have a series of strange nightmares emanating from the research on this story. But you know, the a couple of the other pieces, the Stratton piece, Burwood's story, the story of the mental patient who killed his wife, that always haunted me.
Have there been any murders among people who you know? I mean, have you ever had a friend or family member who's been murdered? I'm just interested, you know, in the sense that you've been so professionally interested in the subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a close friend of our family, a close friend of my mother's and her mother who were killed by the husband in the family, and I think it was much the same situation. I was not a child when that occurred, but it did affect me very profoundly.
Do you think that has to do with your interest as a reporter in crime stories?
I think possibly. I mean, when something so awful occurs in the midst of everyday life, you know, it's like colors look brighter, people are sadder, people are angrier. Everything becomes more vivid, and to a reporter, I mean that it has a certain magnetism that cannot be denied.
You said before that when you were working on Missing Beauty, you had a lot of related nightmares. Would you be willing to share one?
I don't know that the particulars are so fascinating, but the theme that recurred was being alone at night in a place that resembled the convict zone, a labyrinthine center city area, looking through the streets for something. You're being pursued on one hand and looking for something on the other. And I spent so much of my time looking for missing documents, looking for missing links in chronology, looking for aspects of character, that I think it was a sort of a nocturnal metaphor for the investigation.
Are the dreams over now?
Yes, the dreams are over. I think the demon has been exorcised.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Teresa Carpenter's new book is titled Missing Beauty. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What do you have for us?
Well, after quite a bit of debate, the House of Representatives Ethics Committee has decided to begin a preliminary investigation of possible misconduct by House Speaker Jim Wright. The Speaker of the House says he's done nothing wrong and he expects he'll be vindicated. Philippine President Corazon Aquino signed into law a land reform measure that she's long insisted would be at the heart of getting the Philippines on the road to economic recovery. Now that it's law, economists and other experts disagree as to whether it will really help or not. And the big New York International Arts Festival gets underway this weekend, and we tell you how it got pulled all together.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the dance world, male dancers have traditionally had a certain look. But choreographer and dancer Mark Morris has made a name for himself by breaking the mold. Critic at large Laurie Stone has some thoughts on the work of Mark Morris.
Mark Morris, who's a much-acclaimed choreographer and dancer from Seattle, has chunky legs and a boxy chest. Looking at that body, his grade school guidance teacher would probably have said, "Dance? I don't think so." But Morris wanted to be a dancer, and an accomplished, compelling dancer he became, performing in some of the most innovative ballet and modern dance companies in the country. Watching Morris's body, in relationship to the feats it performs, is one of the most thrilling aspects of his work. He celebrates the triumph of artistic will and love of work over the always intransigent raw materials of art, whether they're paint, words, or flesh. Morris wanted to be a choreographer too, and he started making dances when he was 11. By now, at age 31, he's created more than 50 dances, most recently a piece for American Ballet Theater featuring Mikhail Baryshnikov. Morris formed his own company when he was in his early 20s, and his 12-member troupe recently performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I went happily. I'd seen the company twice before and each time been entertained and impressed, as well as somewhat put off. This time I had the same mixture of feelings, and all the signature elements of Morris's work were out front. He loves music, all sorts, and his dances are richly expressive of whatever score is at hand. In this case, the pieces ranged from Mozart to songs by Lou Harrison, which were based on Hopi Indian chants and sung by the New York City Gay Men's Chorus. Morris has a delightfully playful spirit. A lot of his pieces are funny, full of surprising twists and mood shifts. He'll make a dance about anything. In past concerts, there were pieces about wrestling, laundry soap commercials, and porno figures. Morris is openly gay and enjoys deconstructing gender in both his person and his dances. He takes curtain calls with his shoulder-length hair flowing and long earrings dangling. Often in his dances, women pair women and men pair men. Women lift each other and even hoist men in the air, forming refreshingly unconventional patterns and a bold new sensuality on the dance stage. The sexiest piece performed in Brooklyn was also the one I liked best, a dance called New Love Song Waltzes. Counterpointing a somber Brahms score, the dancers frolicked and butted each other, goatish spirits set loose from a midsummer night's dream. There are lots of group gropes and communal, polymorphous, perverse arrangements, flickering with eroticism that quickly disperses and recharges other configurations. Morris uses space ingeniously, especially the floor. The dancers roll and undulate through each other's limbs. They're grounded, earthlings, more of Caliban's party than of Ariel's, like Morris himself. But the sex didn't work for me in One Charming Night, a duet danced by Morris and Terry Wexler to Henry Purcell's music. Morris plays a vampire. Wexler, a petite, sinuous dancer, is a naive country girl. There's a lot of insouciance in their flirtation and much clever, graceful dancing. But Wexler keeps coming off starving for affection, and Morris acts contemptuous of her. He has to suppress his distaste in order to get himself even to bite her. The dance leaves a bad taste. It doesn't matter, though, whether Morris is always on target. He's a young, passionate artist, using what he knows and feels to the max. The self-confidence that enables him to take risks seduces you to his vision. Next time he tours in your vicinity, don't miss the chance to see through his eyes.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with Parati Mukherjee about the people she writes about, the new pioneers, people who, like her, came to America from third world countries and are thriving in a new culture without totally abandoning the values of their country of birth. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Brothers for Life, the new album by saxophonist Earl Turbinton. And TV critic David Bianculli will profile Wise Guy, the CBS crime series. It's about to start its run of summer repeats. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Deborah George, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton, who directed today's show. Research assistance from Martin Foyes and Dan Cornwell. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.